Okay, so the talk I'm going to give here is, so my apologies to Sterl, because this is an extension of a talk that I gave at the Third International LISA conference about a month ago. So I just use this as an opportunity to fill in some of the technical detail that I didn't have time to go into there. So Sterl may feel free to fall asleep in any moments. He's already heard at least half of this.
You're going to neglect the motivation?
I am giving the motivation right now. So the motivation of this, this is a work is all based on stuff I've been primarily focused on for about the past year and a half or so. It's understanding how well gravitational wave observations can be used to map the space-times of a massive compact object, the kind of thing we expect lives, or that we know live in the core of galaxies. And so, you know, my heuristic picture of this is that we have a fairly massive object, probably a Kerr black hole, masses in the range of a million solar masses or so, and a small body that orbits it, okay, with a mass of 1 to 20 solar masses or so. And we know that the properties of the massive object in turn determine the properties of the space-time through which the small body moves. And so the small body's orbits and the gravitational waves that it emits are strongly influenced by the space-time generated by this guy. And so the idea here is to ask, well, I know the gravitational waveforms that this thing emits essentially are some function that depends upon the space-time of the massive compact object. How well can I invert the map and ask, given some measurements, how well some measurements say with the LISA space-based laser gravitational wave detector, how well can I crack this code and ask what space-time is present based on the gravitational waves that I measure? Okay, so the inspiration for this comes from work that was done as part of Fintan Ryan's PhD thesis. He was a grad student at Caltech who is now getting rich on Wall Street. But before he went over to the dark side, he did some beautiful work looking at the properties of space-times of an object with arbitrary multiple moments. And so the way I like to refer to this is to say, can I tell the difference between a Kerr black hole and a Borg cube? Okay? You can imagine we have some object in the center of the galaxy. And I know that the Kerr black hole has a sharply constrained family of multiple moments, depending only on the mass and the spin of the object. Basically, if I can measure two multiples, I know all of them if the object is, in fact, a black hole. Some bizarre object, which I cartoonly represent as a Borg cube here, can essentially have arbitrary relationships among the different multiple moments.
Are you going to assume the Einstein equations?
Yes, I am. And so when I do that, of course, this Borg cube has to be axisymmetric. So in a later transparency that I generated, this is actually a Borg can. nonetheless, this is a good cartoon, so I keep it for aesthetic purposes. So basically, the program that we would like to be able to do with LISA measurements is measure our gravitational waves, figure out what the multiples are of the object through which the small body was orbiting, and then build the compact body space-time. And if we do this, we will either put together a highly detailed test of the properties of a Kerr black hole metric, or make a discovery of some kind of exotic compact body. One of the motivations for Fintan's original study of this research was that Kip Thorne wanted to be able to understand whether we could tell if there was a naked singularity present rather than a black hole, or there was some exotic soliton star, or something like that. So this is the kind of test you'd be able to do with these measurements. So in the course of this talk, what I'm basically going to do is, beginning with this sort of dream of what we'd like to be able to do, I'm going to put up difficulty after difficulty until I whittle my way down to a problem that can actually be solved. So I'm going to argue this is, technology is not at a point where we can do this just yet, calculational technology. So to extract the multiples, I would need to understand, in particular, how to do radiation reaction analyses in a non-black hole space-time. This is a non-trivial problem. The techniques which I'm going to talk about for black holes are really based on the fact that the wave equation for radiation propagating in the Kerr space-time separates, and that allows me to use lots of nice tricks which make it possible to calculate the solution to these to the wave equation to great accuracy and with great detail, and everything just turns out to be happy. That's not going to be the case if I have arbitrary families of multiple moments. Things are going to be a mess. Okay? I think it might be possible to sort of work my way up to this by starting with, say, a family of Kerr multiple moments, then imagine perturbing them so that I get sort of the Kerr wave equation plus a perturbation that might not be separable. But it's a long way to go before we can actually get there. So I am going to focus, to begin with, on black holes. So here's the first thing I've whittled away. I've taken my body of my Borg cube, and I've whittled away the corners and turned it into a curved black hole. Key point we have to make here, though, is that when I measure these waves with LISA, it's going to be sensitive, most strongly sensitive, to the waves that are emitted as a small body is spiraling through the extreme strong field. Okay, it's going to have very fast motion. Gravity is going to be very small, very strong. So a lot of the usual approximations that are used when people talk about calculating gravitational waveforms are no good. Okay, in particular, people, so for instance, the post-Newtonian expansion assumes that the strength of the gravitational field, or the potential, say, M over R, is a small quantity. That's not going to be true here. Also, it assumes that the bodies are moving with slow velocity. These velocities actually get fairly close to the speed of light in some cases. So I need a formalism that allows me to handle high velocities and very strong fields. Okay, fortunately, I have another small parameter I can expand in, because I'm talking about extreme mass ratios. So what I'm going to do is just treat the small body as a perturbation on the Kerr spacetime. Okay? Heuristically, one can imagine writing the spacetime metric as a Kerr piece plus a perturbation, where the magnitudes of, are roughly the order of magnitude of any given component of the perturbation to the full spacetime is mu over m. And this is a procedure to allow me to make some progress. I'm going to make one other assumption, which I will discuss in a little greater detail later, which is that the inspiral is going to happen on an adiabatic time scale. Okay? Basically, what this says is that I'm going to assume that at any given moment, the small body is moving on what is essentially a geodesic. And I'm going to assume it spends many orbits at each geodesic configuration. And what gravitational radiation does, the influence of radiation reaction in this case, is to push the body from one geodesic configuration to the next. Okay, so I'm regarding the inspiral of this body as basically being a sequence of geodesic orbits that I can splice together and generate the full inspiral of the body. So, I'll give you a word of caution.
Why is that assumption necessary? Why are you doing that?
Okay.
To basically evolve the orbital elements in a sense, or
that's what it turns out to be. I'm gonna when I write out the Kolff equation in a little more detail, what you're going to see is that it has a source term, and that source depends upon the world line that the body moves along. Okay, I don't know the radiation reaction corrections. I don't really know the world line. So what I do is assume that the world line is geodesic. That gives me sort of a zeroth order solution that I then can get the first order corrections to. Okay.
But the orbits don't have to be circular,
is that? No, they don't. Okay, in fact, what we'd like to do is consider orbits that are eccentric and inclined. Let me take this out of the sleeve. In that particular case, it turns out adiabaticity may be a bad approximation. So I'm beginning to veer into speculation at this point, because this has not been shown yet. But there's indications that adiabaticity may break down in this case. So why is that? One's naive picture of an inclined circular orbit is that you've got an ellipse tilted at an angle that rotates around the black hole. Okay, that's really wrong. Because of the fact that the orbits, the orbital plane gets dragged around the black hole, this ellipse, at the very least, has to get wrapped around this way. Because, also, the periods for moving through the full range of theta motion and the full range of R motion and its range of phi motion are not the same, you instead end up basically filling a torus in the volume around the black hole. Okay, and it gets filled up ergodically. Just keeps wrapping around and around. If you wait long enough, it will eventually hit every point inside this torus.
It's a numerical result or analytic result that fills up every...
It's going to be a numerical result, I claim. There are indications of this. One of Anna Flanagan's students has done a few sloppy calculations that indicate this, and I'm going to do some analyses right now to show this in greater detail. Yeah.
I think it's a general result of any arbitrary potential, isn't it, in general? Like, you can tell me in physics, it's a general orbit, a general potential.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Unless you carefully choose things so that periods are commensurable and then...
That makes sense, yeah. It's sort of, intuitively seems to me that that's the way it should be. I didn't know there were actual results in this because I'm a lady here and I never read. Yeah?
Is the torus part of the zero-order solution?
Yes. Yes, this is the zeroth order Judaic motion.
So all you need really for the adiabaticity to remain correct is that the gravitational radiation loss time is long compared to the longest of those periods.
That's exactly the point I was going to make. Thank you. So Andrew probably explained better than I would have that what I need then is the gravitational radiation reaction time scale to be longer than the time to come sort of close enough to every point in this volume. It's not clear that this is the case, okay? Especially when I'm in the strong field. It may be the gravitational radiation reaction moves me in faster than the time it would take to sort of fill this whole volume.
Actually, that wasn't what Andrew said. Andrew said that the gravitational radiation time scale should be longer than any of the individual periods, the three periods that make up this orbit.
Oh, okay, that's not what I heard. Okay, what I meant, okay, so correcting your comment then, what has to happen is that the radiation reaction time scale is longer than the time to fill this volume.
Well, why is that? Because the volume is the zero-order trajectory. You have,
it's a precessing orbit, right? So if two of the periods are almost commensurate, but not quite, the difference frequency might be 1,000 times longer than the period, you would mostly stay in one plane and only very slowly process, or you would just do the top and the bottom for us and not fill in the middle or something, except on some very long time scale.
Right. But isn't all of that included in the zeroth order trajectory?
So the point is, though, that is the zeroth order trajectory. So I want to find the first order corrections to that. Okay, for that to be accurate, I have to know that I've actually gone through the full zeroth order motion. Okay, suppose the first order corrections are so strong that I don't actually move through a significant range of the precession, or anything like that.
It's shrinking. So before it's finished precessing, it shrunk to half the radius.
Okay, in that case, using the zeroth order solution was wrong. Okay, I haven't actually gone through the full range of motion there.
But you have used the zeroth order solution, but was part of it.
That's right.
Because you know the zero-order solution.
Perhaps. So this, my point is that, okay, you're getting basically to the point of why this is a problem. Okay, that it may be that will turn out to be good enough. Okay, this may come a little more clear when I discuss the actual source term for the Kolsky equation, why I'm worried about these issues. But nonetheless, you're hitting on the head of why I consider this to possibly be a problem. Okay, it may be that even in a case where I'm evolving sort of faster than the time it takes to go through all these points, the answer is good enough, and I get an accurate representation of the trajectory. Okay, I claim, though, that it is not obvious that is the case, and it may, in fact, introduce significant errors. If it does introduce a problem, then what will basically happen is that your in-spiral trajectory will depend rather strongly, on your initial conditions. Okay. If this is the case, and you evolve through this torus very quickly, then starting here may give you a very different in-spiral trajectory and a very different gravitational wave phasing than if I start over here, which would lead to needing to incorporate the effects of initial conditions into one's analysis of the data and one's ability to try to measure the multiple moments. Bernie Schutz is the first one who brought this point to my attention. He calls these effectively chaotic orbits because you have such a strong dependence on initial conditions in this sense. This isn't really true chaos in the sense that I don't think you can define a phase space where you have a diverging Lyapunov exponent. But for the purposes of trying to analyze your data, it may be chaotic enough to cause a problem. There's been a lot of hubbub recently in the binary community about an even bigger problem, which is that you may have true chaos in the sense of diverging Lyapunov exponents in some kind of a defined phase space arising from spin-spin correlations. So in the case of an extreme mass ratio, the way I think about this is that your body that's spiraling into a black hole is not just a point particle. Okay, it has spin, and the spotic evolution, if one starts with, say, these two bodies fairly close together, separated by 10 or 20 m, and evolves down to the point where they merge, this precession leads to an in-spiral trajectory, which depends extremely strongly on initial conditions and, in fact, exhibits the characteristics of chaos. This has the in-spiral community somewhat worried, because this would cause horrible problems. Most of the work to date that has been done that's, I would say, is reliable, or probably reliable, is in a mass regime that's of interest to ground-based interferometers, LIGO, Virgo, and whatnot. And even though there is probably chaos in these orbits, there's only about 20 or 30 cycles. And if that's the case, we don't really need to worry about being able to follow the phase too closely. There just isn't that much phase that the thing can diverge over. You can probably detect the signals anyway. It has people who think about LISA data analysis, they're terrified. Because as I'm going to show you, you have probably of order 100,000 cycles. And if these things can exhibit a chaotic phase evolution over 100,000 cycles, well, to be blunt, you'd be screwed. Okay? And so.
It's for the supermassive black hole binaries, but if you were talking about a stellar mass object around the supermassive black hole, then you're okay. Are you? Because of the large mass ratio?
I'm going to answer that question on the next slide, or I'm going to speculate on the answer to that.
Holes are okay too, because there you only got 10.
Again, you still only have a small number of cycles.
Okay, so.
I think the answer is.
Okay, so I just want to point out that an attempt to answer this question has been begun by Sterl Finney and his student Mike Carl. In a minute, I will ask if Mike actually has results from his code. They're basically analyzing these equations for physically relevant parameters. So I'm bringing this point up because at the LISA meeting, this occupied an enormous amount of time. There's a lot of hot air spewed about how we're going to be screwed over by this, and there's going to be terrible things that develop, and we should all just go home. I'm going to make an arrogant prediction. Detailed calculations will find no chaos in the extreme mass ratio. Okay? I have no evidence for this, but I have speculation based on past work. My speculation is based on the fact that I believe the chaotic orbits that have been seen before are equivalent to something called transitional precession, which has been seen in analyses of similar mass objects. Okay, that each have spin undergoing an end spiral. Okay, so
let me understand. So you do believe there is chaos when the mass ratio is of order one, but okay.
That's right, and I'll argue why in just a second. So the precession due to the spin-spin and the spin-orbit coupling was studied in the early 90s by Harris Apostolatos, Kurt Cutler, Jerry Sussman, and Kip Thorne. The essential idea of it is that we can define the total angular momentum for the spacetime to be the orbital angular momentum plus the spins of the two objects. When you do this, your J vector defines an overall direction in the spacetime. Okay, if you had eyes that could see spacetime, and you were standing far away and your eyes were all blurry, you were wearing the wrong glasses, it would look like a curved black hole with a total angular momentum of J to some extent. Okay, that J would be the directionality of the spacetime. What one finds when one does these analyses is that the orbital plane, which is orthogonal to the L vector, precesses around J. Okay? Most of the time, this leads to a very simple, gentle precession. Okay, you have some J vector that defines the overall direction, and your L vector just wanders around it at some frequency, which is simple to calculate. This gives rise to some fascinating effects. You end up with a modulation on the phase and the amplitude of the gravitational waveform. But it's not too hard to see what's going on. It's a gentle, moderate effect. When you have the L and your S's combining in such a way that your total J is zero or at least very, very small, the analysis becomes a lot more complicated. Okay, the analytical techniques that are described in the paper that I'm referencing here completely break down, and so they turn into numerical analyses. And what they find is that since there's no longer any overall well-defined direction in the space-time, everything just sort of tumbles. Okay, there's the exact sentence in the paper, which reeks of Kip Thorne, is that the binary loses its gyroscopic bearings and just tumbles wildly. Okay, and it continues doing this until gravitational radiation has reduced L enough that once again there's a direction and it returns to transitional precession. So the reason I'm convinced that there will be no such effect in the extreme mass ratio is that for all the cases for which chaos has been seen, it exactly matches the conditions under which this older research found transitional precession. I think a careful analysis will show that these so-called chaotic orbits are nothing more than transitional precession due to the spin-spin interaction. And if I'm right, we can never, for astrophysically realistic parameters, get L and the S's to cancel one another, and you will never end up with transitional precession, so I claim there will never be chaos. So that's my bold and arrogant prediction, which Has Mike got any results yet?
He probably does, but I don't know them.
Okay, so that will just stand as a bold and arrogant perception, still can't make much more.
So let me understand, so Jana's claim is for a very special alignment of the spins?
Not an alignment of the spins, but for the spins having fairly, so that they start out essentially anti-aligned with one another, or okay, aligned in such a way that they cancel the orbital angular momentum. Okay, and then as they evolve, the point is that they have to be, the spins have to be pretty large, okay? And they're in this regime where they can produce a total angular momentum that's close to zero. Then when you evolve them through, these things tumble like crazy. And she's got all these plots that I do not understand, which show chaos by having some kind of thing called a fractal basin boundary that has...
But it's nearly J equals zero initial.
Yes, I believe so, yeah.
The Japanese results also have A over M.
So there's another case, which I chose not to mention, because I think there may be, after talking with Mike, I think there may be other errors in that paper as well. But there is one result where people have seen, they're claiming to see chaos in an extreme mass ratio. The way they did this, though, was by making their small body have a spin of something like 10 or 20 times its mass. Okay, so a naked singularity spiraling into a black hole could presumably exhibit chaotic orbits. You know, that's far beyond the range of what's physically allowed. So I think that what they've done by making the spin of their small body so large was to cancel out the orbital angular momentum and put them into this regime where transitional precession takes over. Your hand up here.
Yeah, I was just wondering, not about the chaos, but what if the body does have, if the small body does have intrinsic spin, and it over the course of the spiral affect the phase, you know, by saying that?
Yeah, I'm sure it will, because it will go back. So, although I doubt there will be this transitional precession in chaos, I'm quite sure you will still have this more or less gentle precession, where the orbital plane is modulated by this mid-spin interaction. And what that will do is it will lead to having a modulation on the amplitude of the gravitational waveform. Okay. It may look fairly, I've already seen some of this effect in waveforms that I'm going to present later. Alright. Okay, so that's my opinion on chaos, and I'm just sad that Bernie Schultz is not here to be offended by it.
Sorry, it's
I'm sure he would have offered that.
5 minutes of missing tape.
All right, so what I'm going to do for now, even though I think that the spin will in the end not produce a very large problem, or at least not in the sense of inducing chaos, it still makes the analysis of radiation reaction complicated for now, so I'm going to neglect it. And just treat the adiabatic end spiral of a spinless body into a curved black hole. So I'm going to be going on a sequence of geodesic orbits, which basically means that I'm going to start at some initial time, an orbit, okay, I'm drawing my orbits in sort of the fate way, where it actually looks just like a tilted ellipse. So I begin with some initial energy, angular momentum, and Carter constant. It will radiate, and this radiation will carry all these conserved quantities out to infinity and down the black hole. I'm going to imagine I sort of have nets that can catch them so that I can measure the flux of all these quantities, and then change the constants. Okay, the Carter constant, I'm going to hit on a little bit more, so I'm going to discuss it in a little more detail. It's kind of a mess. When the black hole has no spin, it's basically just the other two components of angular momentum. It gets messier as you spin the black hole up, though, because your geometry is no longer spherical, and so it becomes a bit of a mess to define what you mean by X, Y, and Z. And you also get frame dragging in there, which entangles your T and your phi coordinates, so that also sort of entangles E with LZ. And all these things become a bit messy. At the moment, we can't even really do this situation generically because we don't really understand the rate at which Q changes at the gravitational wave flux. When I wrote this transparency originally, I thought that the only way we're going to be able to understand how to do Q is how to evolve Q would be to compute what's called a radiation reaction force. The problem is that Q is constructed out of a quantity which is quadratic in the small body's four momentum. Okay, and so if I ask for changes of it, the change in that looks linear in the four momentum and the change in the four momentum. And so you end up requiring local information. or information about the radiation reaction force that's local to the particle to get anywhere. When I look at the energy and the z component of angular momentum, those go linearly with the four momentum, and I don't end up with the little with the extra p term in there. Basically, a simple way to say this is that there's a cross term that screws things up and appears to require knowledge of the local radiation reaction force. So I gave a talk on a very short version of my initial result on this Simicoe's gravity meeting this year, and I essentially gave an answer to Gary Horowitz when he asked me about it. I now think I'm wrong about this. It may be possible to actually extract the change in Q from just knowledge of the gravitational wave fluxes. I will get to that towards the end, because I have some of the results in my current studies set it up nicely. So for now, though, I am going to restrict attention to systems where the evolution of Q is constrained. In particular, I'm going to restrict myself to so-called circular orbits. Okay? Circular usually doesn't need the prefix so-called, but in this case, it's a little bizarre. These are orbits that are a constant coordinate radius. Okay, the Borel Lincoln's coordinate, particularly in the strong field, might not necessarily correspond to one's usual notion of circular or constant radius. But it turns out that this is a very useful specialization, because it's been shown, actual mathematical proofs, that if I have a circular orbit and it evolves adiabatically to gravitational wave emission, it will remain circular. It passes from one circular configuration to another. So this is probably a fairly artificial system, especially astrophysically, but nonetheless, it's a useful one for developing tools. And because I have this constraint that it must remain circular as it evolves, I can get the rate at which Q changes. Basically, I know that I start at some point with E, L, Z, and Q. I can read from the gravitational wave flux the change in E and L, Z, and then use the constraint that circular remains circular to tell me how Q changes. Okay, so it's a somewhat silly system, but one that turned out to be very useful. One other case can also be handled using this sort of ignore the change in Q formalism, and those are orbits that are eccentric but in the equatorial plane. The reason for that is that those orbits have no Carter constant and it remains with no Carter constant. So,
if you should call those orbits shellular.
Shellular? Right. Yeah, no, that's actually not bad. Maybe something. a picture of them comes from the first analysis of this by Dan Wilkins, did this in 1972. So basically, this is what these things look like. The orbit is restricted to some radius. Okay, this is a very strong field orbit. It uses one-way membrane instead of event horizon for some reason. Basically, it just wanders between a maximum and a minimum latitude. You'll notice that it sort of spirals. The reason for this is that, take this out of the sleeve. The reason for this is that the theta motion and the phi motion have different periods. Okay? If the black hole had no spin, the theta and the phi motions would have the same period, and it would just be a simple circle, not a spiral like this. Okay? The reason for this is just that the geometry has become oblate, which causes an additional precession, and there's frame dragging in there. Generically, we would expect there to be a third frequency as well, associated with the period of the arm motion. And there's a little model I made when I first gave a talk on this. So if you imagine that this black disk is an ellipse of the small body's motion, and this thumbtack is the black hole, you have one frequency which corresponds to this thing running around the ellipse, another frequency which corresponds to the ellipse precessing, and then you have a third frequency which just corresponds to the plane itself precessing like this. All these frequencies are different from one another in general. Okay? If I have a Schwarzschild black hole, then the theta and the phi frequencies become equal to one another, but you always have third frequency to screw you up, or at least a second frequency. All right, so let's set up my sources. I'm ready to start making waveforms. So I'm going to do this in two stages. First, I just pick some orbit, which basically means I'm going to pick the energy, angular momentum, and the Carter constant. Equivalently, since these are just circular inclined orbits, I can map these parameters into a radius and an inclination angle. Okay, that's actually a much more physical way to think about it. I then would solve the Kolsky equation, which is the wave equation that tells me how much gravitational waves are carried away as distinct orbits. I'm going to go into this in a little more detail in a moment. So this gives me the flux of the energy and the angular momentum radiated down out to infinity and down the event horizon, and it also gives me a multiple expansion of the gravitational waveform itself. I then use circularity constraints to find the direction in which radiation reaction pushes the orbit, that tells me the change in E, L, and Q, or equivalently the change in R and the inclination angle, go back to A. Pick a new orbit, repeat. Question or just...
So I'm worried about something.
Okay. Know,
but it's probably my own ignorance. I'm worried about this constraint of circularity that comes from the say diabetic evolution. I mean, how certain are you that is true when you... that's what I'm worried about. I'm trying to figure this out in my own brain, so maybe I shouldn't ask this question.
Well, my answer to that is that for these somewhat unphysical systems, as long as the mass ratio is very extreme, I'm not worried about it. Certainly, when I go to a more realistic orbit that's not circular, and if I... Basically, the timescales for radiation reaction are set by the mass ratio. So if the mass ratio is not extreme enough, you might then worry about it again. Okay, so let me discuss the Kolb equation briefly. Basically, this is the wave equation for a perturbation to the space-time's curvature. Okay, so we'll talk about curvature perturbations rather than metric perturbations. The reason I use this is that it was proven in Saul Tucholsky's PhD thesis that the wave equation for this separates in curved space-times. If I looked at the wave equation for H, for the metric perturbation, it would not separate. It's also very useful because I can get, essentially with no work, information about the radiation flux at infinity from this quantity. Okay, it's just directly related to the two polarizations of the gravitational waveform. So it's very easy, once I've constructed this, to get the energy flux and the angular momentum flux. So with some effort, one can also show that this provides fluxes down the horizon. And you know, everyone in the field just uses Hawking-Hartle results. And you can turn this around and get E dot and LZ dot down the horizon as well. Okay, so this basically gives me everything that I need. There's a few details on the calculation. So to separate, for the wave equation to actually separate, I need to break up this curvature perturbation using a goofy multipolar decomposition. So there's two parts that are trivial. The phi and the t dependents just drop right out because the space-time is, after all, axisymmetric and stationary. The theta dependence is given by spin weighted spheroidal harmonic. Okay, it's basically just a spherical harmonic on steroids. Okay, all I've done is expanded functions in an oblate geometry rather than a spherical geometry, and for fields that have certain rotation properties, which the little minus two signifies. The R is harder. Okay, so that's governed by this ordinary differential equation, but once again, there are tools to do that. It's not too difficult. In particular, the R function encapsulates the source T. And this source is going to be where I put all of my information regarding my orbit. Okay, so source is just given by doing an integral over some big god-awful mess that depends upon the stress energy tensor of a little orbiting particle. Okay, so you know, if you're for some bizarre reason actually interested in the details of this, we can talk later. The main thing I want you to get out of this is that the source of the Tucholsky equation depends on whatever stress energy tensor governs your small bodies. Okay. So since I'm doing point particles here, it's basically the mass of the point particle times the delta function. And here's the answer to the question that Omer had asked me a while later. I have to put into this delta function the particle's world line. Okay, so this tells me where the particle is at any moment of time. I don't yet know the particle's world line to all orders. I can only, with confidence, state that at zeroth order, it follows a geodesic. So I put the geodesic motion in here as a source for this, find the source term for the geodesic motion, and then all this stuff will give me the first order corrections to that. And this then also gives you an answer to a question that Andrew had asked me earlier. You're wondering why it is that I'm concerned, why I'm so concerned about adiabatic timescales. This integral goes from minus infinity to infinity. Okay, so I need to really know all of the zeroth order motion in order to construct the source function. Okay, if I only have a piece of it, I'm not guaranteed that I've actually done it right. My hunch is that this integral probably has somewhat compact support so that I don't need to worry about that too much. And you know, I can probably control the amount of error I have by, say, truncating the integral at some finite time, but that has not been established yet. So I'm somewhat worried about it, but just say I don't have trouble sleeping in
there. Yeah? There are two pieces in that. One is in the approximation that you're just evolving the orbit by figuring out the energy in LZ that are removed by the gravitational waves. And that, I think, does require that the orbit really fills out the torus.
Yeah.
Because if it just if one of the periods is nearly commensurable, a pair of the periods are nearly commensurable, and you just filled out a piece,
right,
then that claim is defined by the initial conditions, not by the EALZ. So that's sort of, in, even if you put in the restricted piece of the particle's world line there, that would be incorporated in your back reaction terms.
Right.
So those
right.
are two pieces that are going in.
Yeah. No, I certainly agree with that. One thing, worrying about these incommensurate periods, what you can do, I think we talked about this a little bit briefly, but we can often do some clever things. So, for instance, one of the periods can usually be ignored because you can do a lot of this analysis in a frame that co-rotates to, say, the phi period, so you don't have to worry about your theta and your r motion. But you still have to worry about these issues even for those two periods, because you can imagine that those two periods are somewhat commensurate with one another and leads to problems. Okay, so that's the details on how one constructs a Tucholsky quasi solution. Let me just remind you of the game that I'm playing here. I'm going to show you then basically what happens when I pick a whole family of orbits, do this, find the radiation reaction, and then repeat this over and over again to see how the orbits behave. What one produces is a field of tangent vectors. Okay? So the way to interpret this is that as a function of radius and inclination angle, if I go to this point, radiation reaction tends to drive me in this direction. Okay? The dotted line here is the set of the last state of marginally bound orbits. Okay, if an orbit over here is unstable with small perturbations, and so it emits a tiny bit of gravitational radiation and plunges right into the black hole. So I'm going to ignore them, but all the rest of these orbits are somewhat well behaved. I'm only going to give results in this talk from one particular spin diode, sort of Kip Thorne's famous diode, 0.998, at which black holes driven by thin disk accretion tend to be buffered. I've been doing analyses for other ones as well, but just that's a lot of data, and I don't want to show a lot of data in this talk.
Scott,
yeah.
Under the conditions in which these approximately circular orbits are valid, do you get the same answer under those conditions if you do it this way and if you explicitly integrate the radiation reaction forced field?
I don't know. I hope so. But no one's constructed that radiation reaction equation.
One doesn't know how to write down that equation.
Right, this is the same. Yeah, but for the cases that have been written down, because you had a list of, like Alan, I noticed a list of names of people who have tried to write.
That's right. So, I mean, those, they still have not actually, so what those people have given is a prescription for calculating the radiation reaction force. It's a big research program right now by.
It's a prescription, which is like Feynman patent, right?
Okay, so the radiation reaction force is not yet known, right? Particularly, it's not known for, I mean, to give you an idea of where things stand, and a lot of the cutting edge work on this is assuming that the interaction is a scalar field rather than a gravitational field, okay? Okay, no one, that's not quite true, Mino in Japan has done some work on radiation reaction forces using gravitational interactions. But he's done it using sort of a post-Newtonian approximation. So, you know, I'm interested in very strong fields here. Can you sort of be relevant to, you know, that axis being out in the interaction or not there?
Is there a simple reason why the inclination tends to not change very much?
I don't know. That is kind of a mystery. I'm going to comment on that a little bit later. Okay. So stage two, then, that's the first stage, is I've built this sort of field of tangent vectors. Second stage, I'm going to actually build a trajectory that a small body would follow. Okay, if I start out at one end of this tangent vector, I can sort of go along this and follow the tangents, build the actual trajectory one gets. This is useful because it tells me what the shape of the trajectory will be, how much the inclination angle changes, and also gives me time scales, tells me how quickly it moves through this. And when I do this, I can also compute the waveform that one generates. So
you are, in a sense, evolving orbital, quote-unquote, orbital elements here.
Quote-unquote, yeah, but I'm doing it in this sort of funny way where I'm saying, okay, it's a geodesic orbit here, and there's another geodesic orbit here, and I'm just sort of pushing myself from one geodesic to the next. Okay, so this is what you end up getting. If I put my mass ratio at 10 to the minus 6, and assume the big black hole is a mass of a million solar masses, and you can see even more clearly in this picture, a thing that Jim Harwell noticed, that the trajectories are quite flat. Okay, and with the particular parameters I've chosen, you'll notice it takes something like a year and a half to inspiral. This one goes from 4M to the last stable orbit here. Okay, which is a very interesting time scale for these observations. Now, when I did this, I sort of did the calculation the correct way. I analyzed how these orbits evolve as I go from, or as I include radiation going out to infinity and down the event horizon. And it had always been the conventional wisdom, at least for sources people thought about in regard to LIGO, that radiation down the event horizon is not very important. So just to see what happened, I multiplied all my fluxes down the horizon by zero. Let me just write down a few numbers here, just to remind you. So, when I do this, you see that time at an inclination angle of zero is about 635 days. Okay? And all the others sort of scale somewhat from that. If I throw away the flux to down going down the horizon, the flattest trajectory down here at an inclination angle of zero takes about 610 days. Okay, it's almost 3 weeks faster to inspiral in. So I have two comments on that. First of all, that's a very big effect. I'm not showing it in this plot, but I can also do this asking the number of orbits that are that one generates as one spirals through here. This one here is about 20,000 fewer orbits than the other case where I included both fluxes. Okay, that would have a very drastic effect on the phase evolution of the waveform. Second, strikes me at least naively, this is a counterintuitive result. Okay, radiation going out to infinity and down the horizon appear to be two sinks. And yet, when I get rid of one of those sinks, I lose the energy faster. So what's going on? Well, the idea is that you can recast this notion of radiation going down the horizon as being the tidal deformation of the black hole's event horizon. So you should be fairly familiar with this work.
I thought it was counterintuitive.
Yeah. And so what happens here can be really understood in terms of tidal coupling. If I have a black hole with a small body close to it, the tidal field of that small body raises a bulge on the event horizon of the black hole. And since this thing is rapidly rotating, that bulge gets dragged in advance, at least looked at spatially, of the particle. It then exerts torque back on this thing, which tends to torque it in a way that increases its orbital energy.
So you do correct the black hole parameters during the...
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So that this basically, what I do is, I go from one to the next, but how I measure the fluxes going out to infinity down the event horizon tells me how to go from one to the other. Okay. When I don't include the radiation down the horizon, what I'm saying here is that I generate a very different sequence. I move from orbit to orbit at a very different rate. Okay, so this is, I find it's a very attractive picture of looking at this. It correctly gives you the magnitude of the torque. And it also shows you that as I decrease the black hole spin, this effect gets smaller and smaller. And in fact, eventually, it actually switches sign. Okay, imagine I'm in a frame that's sort of co-rotating with the orbital velocity of this thing. If this were a Schwarzschild black hole, then this bulge would be in the opposite direction. This small body would be orbiting too fast for the bulge to sort of keep up with it. And then the torque is in the opposite direction. It tends to spiral in faster.
Scott?
Yeah?
I have a question which I think is silly, but I don't understand why the black hole can have a bulge. I thought that it doesn't have bulges. It just has a mass.
But this isn't a black hole in isolation. It has a small body in there. Okay, so the bulge is an artifact of its interaction with this environment. The environment, in this case, is a little particle. Okay, another reason why I find this picture very attractive is that I believe it will make it possible for us to compute the rate at which Q changes. So I made a lot of noise in the past that to get the change of Q, I'm going to need to know radiation reaction forces. Okay, I think it's a lot of hooey now. If I have a non-equatorial orbit, my tidal bulge will be non-equatorial. Okay, and so the direction of torque due to the bulges is going to change the inclination angle of the orbit. Change of inclination angle is nothing more than a change in the Parker and the Carter constant. So calculations relevant to the weak field of this sort of an effect and for basically non-orbiting sources, sort of a particle that's being magically held, have been done by Saul Tucholsky and Paul Kranowski, I think his name is pronounced. Seems to be missing some vowels. Anyway, these guys did these calculations years ago in the weak field. And so one of the things I'm currently trying to work on is understand how one can take these calculations into the strong field and think about doing this in a multiple expansion. I would also need to figure out a way to account for radiation to infinity, but I think that that can be done in a very simple way, which I'm not too confident of, that I don't want to go into right now.
And some tidal coupling, which is changing the inclination angle, or radiation to infinity also changes the inclination.
Radiation also changes the inclination angle. I don't want to go into that right now, because that's a big aside, we can talk about that later. Okay, so having assumed that I've gotten the n-spiral trajectories, I now want to generate the gravitational waveform. So I use the multiple decomposition. I basically just need to reassemble the multiples to produce my waveforms as functions of time. Okay, and so these things depend, in particular, on the n-spiral trajectory, which can really be an r of t and an inclination angle of t, and this complex amplitude that I computed with the Nikolsky equation, which is this guy. And now I just need to do a sum over a large number of multiples. For the purposes of my numerics, I'm going to set infinity to 4. I have indications that that actually may not be a bad approximation, as I will argue later. When one does this...
That's a little too cavalier. What infinity? What do you mean?
I'm sorry. So the infinities in the sums.
Oh, I see. Okay, sorry.
Thank you. Yeah, that was a little cavalier. So when one does this, one gets a gravitational waveform which, you know, it chirps, okay? At initial times, the top plot is the waveform at a very early time. You can see the influence of all the various harmonics, and it gets higher and higher frequency. I find these plots to be fairly meaningless, though, okay? It's a waveform and it wiggles, big surprise. So that's why I have the computer set up here. We can also take this and turn it into a sound. And so what I'm going to show you is exactly this waveform turned into a sound. It begins with an inclination angle of 20 degrees at a radius of 4m.
But we don't have a year.
And I've rescaled all the masses so that it won't take a year. Lock the doors. Okay, in the beginning here, you can hear modulation, which is due to the theta and the phi motions being incommensurate with one another. Comment on. The vast majority of that, aside from the modulation, is sort of if you've heard any talk in gravitational waves, you've heard something similar to that. It's something that chirps and gets louder and of higher frequency. But towards the end there, you'll notice that there was actually a strong component of this that went down in frequency. Okay, that's a surprise. I was not expecting that to happen. What appears to be happening here is that in this multiple expansion of the waveform, there is some component that is occurring at different frequencies, okay, where either m or k is negative and the other is positive. And the amplitude for that is non-trivial. The two frequencies are evolving at different rates, and one of them basically catches up and passes the other at some point. And so the difference frequency becomes smaller. Okay, this is a big surprise, and is the kind of thing that I was not expecting to see. It's kind of exciting to point out the kind of unusual features we see in these very strong field evolutions. But it's also possibly kind of frightening, because there's a lot of power at these things that surprise us. And we have to be very careful when we think about how to analyze this data. Okay, so punchline of the analysis of the signal is that we have a very complex harmonic cycle, harmonic structure. And keep in mind, I've also strongly restricted my source form. Okay, when I go to real signals, things that have all three frequencies present, R frequencies as well as theta and phi, or even and incorporating spin, the way that it modulates, the spin of the small body that is, the way it will modulate the waveform, we can get even more complicated things. So my speculation is that match filtering techniques, constructing a large bag of templates and then trying to go in and find a match between the two of them, is likely to be completely impractical. Okay, this could be bad news. Sam Finn and Kip Thorne have recently shown in analysis the match filtering at the signal noise ratios already might be on the low end. Okay, they do, looking at sources that are about a gigaparsec away, they find match filtering signal noise ratios for the match ranges that I'm looking at of no more than about 5 to 10. And that's assuming that I've gotten all the power and I've concurrently added it all together. If I can't concurrently add it all together, I'm in trouble. So I would say there's an urgent need at the moment to investigate how well we can do without templates. One idea I've had, which is based on a suggestion by Sam Finn, is that I can rewrite the waveform in a way such that the only things that are sort of non-trivial are the amplitude and the phase. It's the same kind of thing people generally do using, say, restricted post-Newtonian expansion in studies of equal or comparable math binaries. If I then go in and compute this trajectory to high accuracy, perhaps needing thousands of multiples, but nonetheless, since the trajectory depends only on the energy and angular momentum that's radiated, I don't need detailed phase information to get it correctly. I may then be able to assemble the waveform using a relatively small number of multiples. This is why I said that infinity equals 4 for the sum may not be such a bad thing. In this sum, at least, I can probably restrict the number of multiples that are present as long as I've used enough to get this trajectory very accurately. Doing this might provide a framework for data analysis based on techniques such as something that Tom Prince and Richard A. have developed called discrete Church transform, which is essentially a generalization of the fast Fourier transform that allows you to look for phases that don't just evolve linearly with time as a Fourier transform does, but ones that have other arbitrary shapes. So this function here would be my other bizarre shape. I think if I parameterize it this way, if I can get some understanding of the shapes, this may be a way to go in and look for the signals at much less computational cost. So let's see. Let me just end here with a summary. I believe that the restricted orbits at this point are completely solved in principle, and they're nearly done so in practice. The only other really interesting restricted orbit are the orbits that are eccentric and in the equatorial plane. That is currently being analyzed by Dan Kenefick and students at University of Wales in Cardiff and Kostas Kormadakis. I've seen the results. Looks like they've got some bugs, but they're making progress. Over the course of the next year, I may generalize my code to look at these as well so that we can be a little more confident what's happening. Based on these ideas for computing the analysis of the evolution of the Carver constant and my planned future work at looking at these issues of adiabaticity and then sort of ergodic filling torus, I think we may be able to look at unrestricted orbits as well, probably within the next year or two. It's going to be difficult to get the inspiraling body structure. Spin, for example, another one that Roger Glanford and student are looking at is imagine that the small body is a white dwarf and looking for resonances between its vibrational modes and the orbital frequencies. The analyses are beginning.
If it's not a white dwarf, you're worried about time disruptions. You're excluding a lot of it.
Well, if it's a compact body, I don't think so.
If it's a white dwarf.
If it's a white dwarf, yeah. Well, that's in fact exactly what Roger Glanford is looking at. He's interested in understanding where essentially pumping energy into the vibrational modes will disrupt it. So that's one of Roger's main research focuses at the moment among his students. Finally, in the end, what we'd really like to be able to do, at least what I'd like to be able to do, is give the massive body a more detailed multi-part structure than just a Kerr black hole. Even though I'd be quite surprised if we discovered it being anything other than a Kerr black hole, I need to have some kind of family of solutions, some kind of family of waveforms or something that would allow me to test the existence of these different multiples. And it would be wonderful to be able to go in there and say, well, I can accurately measure the first 5 multiples, and beyond the first 2, it's completely consistent with a Kerr black hole. To be able to make that kind of a statement, though, I really need to be able to do a detailed analysis of a complex multipolar body, and I don't think anyone's really given any thought to that beyond work that Finn and Ryan did before he left for Wall Street. So that's basically where everything stands now. Thanks.
So is there so in the Newtonian case, but sort of the old Peters Matthews is all about eccentricity and more rapidly. Do you have some reason to believe that's not going to happen here?
No. I believe rate eccentricity probably does continue to damp fairly rapidly. storm field analyses for Schwarzschild were done by Eric Rosson and Kurt Codler and Dan Kanafek when they were at Caltech. And they found that the eccentricity doesn't damp quite as fast as the Peter Matthews result, and actually does switch sign at some point. But the astrophysical relevance of that sign switching in these parameters is probably irrelevant. I think one of the interesting questions is to ask, as far as these observations are concerned, does the eccentricity damp enough that these orbits, these things should be expected to be circular by the time it enters Lisa fans? I think the conventional wisdom of that is that it will not. These things are likely to be, when they're captured, when they're bound strongly up to the black hole, they begin to really be driven by gravitational radiation reactions. They are probably likely to have eccentricities on the order of somewhere around 0.6 to 0.9, and they get bound with a periastron so close that they remain with a very large eccentricity by the time they enter Lisa fan.
You kind of check what the messy astrophysical interaction between the, say, an inspiring star and the radiation field of an AGN might be in terms of its effect on the orbit compared with the gravity wave emission.
I have not, but I think at least some work in that vein has been done by Ramesh and Orion. What he was actually looking at was viscous interaction of the inspiring body with an accretion disk. And summarize his results. If you have ADAP accretion, basically assumed, he found that the time scale through which the viscous interaction changes the orbital parameters is about 7 orders of magnitude longer than the time scale in which, or it's greater than 7 orders of magnitude longer than the time scale which gravitational radiation reaction changes the orbital parameters. So, was that clear? Basically, for ADAP interactions, it's probably that does not significantly influence the waveforms. You have thin disk present, though. Things are much different, and you probably have significant changes. The interaction with the disk has a very significant effect. Yeah.
Well, I suppose you have an instrument with a very good signal-to-noise observation. But before applying the convolution technique, is there any footprint that you can may find from observation that tell you that you are in the right assumption, the assumption that you used were correct, basically the circular assumption? Is there any signature you could expect to have in your data in order to be sure that you can go on?
Possibly. I think to answer that question, we're going to need to know a little bit more about the non-circular inclined orbits. It's possible that there will be some kind of a footprint that tells us, for instance, that only two evolving frequencies are extremely important as opposed to three. But having not looked at the case where all three frequencies are present, I really can't answer that yet.
That's sure, there are no integral. I don't know anything about these topics, but are there no integral of motion or things like those you can apply in order to test first of going on to test whether that.
The problem is that I can't tell what those are until I've done that deconvolution and figured out done the detailed data analysis.
There is a little bit. It's not doing gravitational radiation, but there are these Czech astronomers, Karoli and somebody, who've done geodesic analysis of these orbits, so you just get a limited section before the gravitational radiation and change the radius very much, and done Fourier analysis of the periods, and basically the difference between circular and the general case is two periods rather than three, and you get in a Fourier transform, you can then look for the, or try to find commensurable periods and so on.
Right, so that's sort of what I was trying to indicate. But I think the problem is that even to be able to do, because these frequencies are changing, to do that Fourier transform, you have to do the whole deconvolution and understand the end spiral trajectory, because the frequencies start changing so quickly that all your power gets smeared out over a large number of frequency bands. So you have to find a way to sort of coherently add them all back up together.
Okay.
We want you here.
If you assume that this small body has no spin, but it comes close to the spinning black hole, I presume it's going to acquire some spin anyway.
A real body would, yeah. And remember, in my analysis, my body had zero radius. I think it'd be a point particle.
So if it's a black hole, for example, is this going? If it's the most compact you can imagine, this is going to be significant.
I don't know what the magnitude of that effect is. This sounds like it touches on stuff you did with Kurt Cutler.
Well, it's only dynamical.
That's right. You did everything with on your cyclic timescale, and that analysis has not been done, but I for black holes, I'm going to make an arrogant off the cuff remark, they're probably compact enough that wouldn't be a significant effect.
But the spin of the, I guess, once, so you can estimate it roughly by saying that once the black hole, the compact black hole gets to the horizon of the massive black hole, it's spinning roughly with the same spin as the massive black hole, I would assume.
That would surprise me. I think it spirals in too quickly for it to get spun up that much.
No, it's just a matter of conservation of the gravity-magnetic flux through the small body. It doesn't actually matter how quickly it spirals.
We should talk about this more. I'm not seeing that. What
were you going to ask for? Yeah, I was going to try an arrogant counterexample to your arrogant statement.
Okay.
I think there might be a sort of funny kind of chaos. Let's consider your circular orbits.
Yeah.
For a given inclination, which is approximately fixed, as you found, the ratio of the theta and the phi periods will depend on the radius. There'll be some function of the radius. And so as the object spirals in, my guess would be that as you vary the radius, a series of discrete values in the radius, you will find the two periods commensurable.
So
in general orbits that it goes through, for most of the radii, the period won't be commensurable, and your approximations might be quite good, but for a particular discrete set of values that it will go through, they'll become commensurable, and perhaps you heard that there. And then the analysis will break down, and how it gets through that region will depend on the details of the initial conditions.
That's possible, but remember, I made a comment to you that when I actually did this analysis, one of the details I left out of here, I go into, so at least as far as how this affects the theory, I don't think that's really that big an issue, because with two frequencies, if I only have two frequencies, what I can do is analyze my source, the frame that co-rotates at one of those frequencies, and I essentially only have one, and I can do my Fourier transforms exactly, and I can construct my source with no trouble. If I have three frequencies, though, I can't do that trick. And what you're suggesting might then begin to have a really big impact.
Okay, so you see what I guess what in the rotating frame what you should see is suddenly going from having all harmonics represented suddenly only like two or three be present.
Okay.
You actually
I have four.
Thanks, Scott.
Thanks.